courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand?
You hold my hand!
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Joe Manchin scrambles to find 60 Senate votes to save his permitting reform as progressives and most Republicans look to be objecting. Is the bill good enough to deserve support? Plus, Al Gore and John Kerry try to stage a coup at the World Bank against President David Malpass so they can turn the bank into a guarantor of climate loans, public and private. Will they succeed? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigo here with Kim Strassel and Joe Sternberg. Welcome to you both. First, let's listen to Joe Manchin, Senator from West Virginia, make his case on Fox News Sunday for passing his permitting reform.
Shan, this is not about me. My Republican friends, I've been working for 12 years with them, and I know their number one item that they've had and number one priority they've had is permitting reform. We can't build anything in America. It takes 5 to 10 years. The developed world takes 1 to 3 years. And why should we be so far behind the developed world to bringing products to market, to be able to have the infrastructure to move energy around? And we're asking people around the world to do things for us we won't do for ourselves. My Republican friends know exactly where we are. This is not about the previous legislation. This is something, a high priority that we have for our country. It's a time in history.
A time in history. So Joe Manchin had cut a deal with Chuck Schumer, the Democratic Senate leader, that in return for Manchin's vote to pass the Inflation Reduction Act, and in that vote was the decisive one, which passed that big tax increase and enormous climate subsidies. In return for that vote, Schumer would get Manchin a vote on permitting reform by the end of September. Now, they're trying to get that this week as part of the so-called continuing resolution bill, the fund the government, which by the current funding expires on September 30th. So, Kim, you heard the senator. He also made his plea in our pages today to try to get this passed, no doubt trying to appeal to Republican senators who are on the fence. How persuasive do you think his case is?
Well, here's a problem for Joe Manchin. If you read that op-ed that he has with us, he'll lay out why he thinks this is honest regulatory reform. He points out that his bill would set deadlines for how long agencies have to work on these projects in terms of getting their permits out, that he would require simultaneous agency reviews and therefore reduce the time for permitting from what is currently 5 to 10 years down to under 3. He also says his bill deals with this other big elephant in the room, which is litigation, that it would cap how long plaintiffs have to bring lawsuits and require agencies to act quickly when permits are sent back to them by the court. But the problem, Paul, and as Republicans understand, is that when you actually read through his bill, he seemed to have sold his vote for this bigger Joe Biden priority on the cheap, because there's not a lot of substance here. Yeah, there are some deadlines set up, but there's absolutely nothing that compels agencies to comply with them. And if, as we know, agencies routinely blow through deadlines. So beyond the law saying you must do this, there's nothing that happens to an agency if they don't. And while there are some statutes of limitations for how long plaintiffs have to sue, it does nothing to reform the underlying statutes like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, which is what allows for these sprawling lawsuits in the first place that can be brought by basically anybody. So Republicans know this. They put forward their own alternative. I have no doubt Joe Manchin is honest when he says he believes this is an important moment in time. But the worry I think Republicans have is that you pass something that doesn't really do anything, and then all momentum forever doing reform goes away.
Your point on lawsuits, Kim, is absolutely right. The provision says that a lawsuit against a project has to be filed within 150 days. Okay, great. The problem is that it doesn't limit the causes of action. So there's no change in the causes of action that can be filed under the NEPA Act, for example, which is the granddaddy of all environmental laws and is basically the uber obstruction legislation that is used by litigants and courts to block projects. And the bill does nothing about that. Now, I should tell you that Joe Manchin called me on the weekend. He was not happy with our editorial on Saturday on the permitting bill, which called it Joe Manchin's permitting bust. And he wanted to get his reply into the paper. And I said, fine, sure, we'll get that in. But, you know, he does have a problem here. And his argument basically on NEPA and these other laws is, you can't get it passed. There's no Democrats who are going to support me on that. So his argument is, don't hold out for what cannot be achieved. Take what can be achieved now and hope that, you know, in the future we can have a debate about the rest. But if you want to get anything done now, this is what you have to do, Joe. So what do you make of that political logic?
It's kind of an odd admission for him to be making, because really that argument is conceding that he got the sequencing on this all wrong when he agreed to vote for the green package billed as the Inflation Reduction Act in the first place before he got all of the permitting stuff in writing. Because the reality is that some of this more substantive permitting reform might have been achievable several months ago if he still had the leverage available of saying to some of his Democratic colleagues in the Senate, look, if you want to get this through, you have to give us a more substantial permitting reform that, by the way, might also have the political virtue of achieving some bipartisanship by peeling off some Republican votes who would at least support the bigger permitting reform. But we're having instead the kind of conversation that we're having now because he did not do that, because he decided to take Chuck Schumer and some of Manchin's Democratic colleagues at their word that they would do a permitting reform. And I think that a lot of the argument now, to my ear, has the flavor of trying to make a virtue out of necessity, which is he's kind of stuck with the minimalist permitting reform that he thinks can at least attract enough Democratic votes to get it through, especially given that some, you know, Democrat members of the Senate, such as Bernie Sanders, are going to, you know, be very opposed to anything that is at all more substantial than what's on the table right now. And so I think that Manchin is really scrambling to try to get anything that he can to at least say that he did succeed in getting some form of permitting reform done.
My reporting suggests, Kim, that Manchin needs probably about 15 Republican votes to get to 60. He's got most of the Democrats on board, but Bernie Sanders and Ed Markey of Massachusetts are formally declared, and he may not be able to get a couple of others or they may be out. So the calculation is he needs about 15, and he's got a lot of Republicans. I mean, Mitt Romney's on board, Rob Portman's on board, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia is on board with him, but I think he's still a couple of votes short, thus the scramble over the weekend on the TV shows and so on. We'll see if he can get it. And it comes down, I think, for calculation for Republicans, Kim, to something like this. Accept this now and then hope you can get more later, or block this now and hope the political pressure rises on Democrats to do something on permitting if the Republicans take Congress in November. Of course, the problem there is that Democrats can always use the filibuster to stop it. So you'd have to get significant Democratic buy-in, and that's where Manchin says you just can't get it. So as you look at this, do you think he's going to get the support, and should he, from the Republicans?
I'm not sure he is. And here's the other additional reason why is, I mean, I think you're right about that calculation for Republicans. I think what the problem is for many, many of them, and that this view is actually rising among the caucus, is that this bill isn't necessarily a marginal improvement. I mean, yes, there are some things that are in there. You can certainly understand where Joe Manchin is coming from. But because he caved so much, it's potentially got some really bad provisions in it that could make things worse. For instance, and you know, just to give you a couple of examples, one thing is the president is allowed under Joe Manchin's bill to designate 25 energy projects of strategic national importance, but only 5 of those have to be fossil fuels or biofuels, meaning ethanol, which is not really kind of a fossil fuel project anyway. So that leaves the ability for the White House to use all the benefits of this bill primarily for renewable projects, not for fossil fuel projects, which was explicitly what Joe Manchin promised this would be about, easing the way for some of the bottlenecks because of leftist opposition. You know, there's also a provision in here that gives the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, the ability to override states that have objections to certain power lines crossing over them. Now, the ability for states to veto this has been a problem in some ways, but this new rule in this statute would in fact specifically be about allowing FERC to impose over states connections to what we call intermittent energy, which is essentially a renewable grid. So all of the states out there that have renewable mandates that are very costly for them, this would suddenly require other states that do not to essentially subsidize their ambitions. So there's some bad things in here, and that's what Republicans are looking at. And I think many of them are thinking, look, let's just hold out on this. At some point, the regulatory crunch is also going to hit Democrats and their renewable projects, and then maybe they'll be more willing to do a holistic reform.
Right. Meantime, we should mention that Joe Manchin in this bill would get his Mountain Valley Pipeline, which is 95% done, and would move gas from West Virginia through to the southeast, natural gas, and is much needed, and we've editorialized in favor of it, but he would finally get that done with some of the provisions here. So he'd get that for him, very significant project at least completed. All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what looks like an attempted coup at the World Bank, engineered by none other than Al Gore, when we come back.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Joe Sternberg. And I want to talk about what looks to be an attempted coup here, engineered by none other than, at least instigated by none other than former Vice President Al Gore, and of course, the legendary climate activist. Let's listen to Al Gore talking last week at an event sponsored by the New York Times.
We need to get a new head of the World Bank, for God's sake. This is ridiculous to have a climate denier as the head of the World Bank. Since almost 90% of the increased emissions going forward are coming from developing countries, we have to take the top layers of risk off the access to capital in these developing countries. That's the job of the World Bank, to coordinate the other multilateral development banks, and they're simply not doing it. We need to get rid of that leadership, put new leadership in, and I hope President Biden will take that initiative.
We will hear from the World Bank president later.
Good. Tell him I said hello. Tell him I said goodbye.
Al Gore, gracious as always. Let's listen to the New York Times reporter basically taking Al Gore's message to David Malpass.
I've never met him. He's not involved in the efforts that we're doing. He may present as a climate person. I don't know what impact that's having.
Okay. Let me just be as clear as I can. Do you accept the scientific consensus that the man-made burning of fossil fuels is rapidly and dangerously warming the planet?
I don't know if everyone wants to comment on that. What we are doing is having impactful projects that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We have a mission of a World Bank that's powerful.
Will you answer the question? Is that?
I don't even know. I'm not a scientist, and that is not a question. So Al Gore can put. I don't know why it stays on the stage. What we need to do is move forward with impactful projects.
Well, you can tell where the New York Times was coming from with that. And also, that was not David Malpass's most eloquent moment. On the other hand, I'm not sure why he would bother to appear at a New York Times event like that when it's all just aimed at badgering him. My guess is there's something of a setup here. John Kerry, the president's climate envoy, also badgering not Malpass by name last week, but talking about these development banks to get with it on climate change. David Malpass's term expires in 2024. It's a five-year term. He started in 2019, appointed by Donald Trump. David Malpass has extensive international economic experience. Joe has served in the Reagan administration and international role, and then in the Trump administration, the senior administration role. How do you read what Gore and Kerry are up to here?
Well, I think that the key point that has been developing in a lot of these climate discussions over the past couple years, and this really fully flowered last November at COP26 in Glasgow in the United Kingdom, is this notion of really trying to mobilize financial markets behind all of these climate goals. Because I think that political mobilization, getting elected lawmakers to sign up for a lot of this green energy stuff, is proving harder and harder. You know, in the developed world, we see how unreliable it is. In the developing world, the problem is that it's very expensive in addition to being unreliable. And so my take of what's going on here is that the climate activist left really understands that even with all of the subsidies that are developed country governments are pouring into green energy projects, even with the enthusiasm of a lot of private capital, various asset managers in the West for these projects, it's still very difficult to get the economics of that to work out. And so what they want is to be able to rope in large institutions like the World Bank to offer additional financial support for a lot of these green projects. And the problem is that an experienced international economist like David Malpass is a bit too smart to get dragged into that sort of from a risk-reward perspective, and also too focused on the World Bank's core economic mission of supporting economic development in a lot of these places. And so that is one theory I can think of for why Malpass is becoming a target here.
So first point, Malpass didn't deny anything. And of course, after that exchange, he later did say, look, I believe greenhouse gases are playing a role in global warming. It's hardly a controversial thought. Humans interact with the climate. Of course, they have a role on the climate. But the money quote there in the Al Gore clip was that we have to take the risk off the top of capital markets and investment in the developing countries, Kim. That is the essence of what he wants. He wants to take the World Bank, take its loan guarantee power, and guarantee climate loans, private and public, in the developing world for climate projects, whether or not, no matter the risk, whether or not they'll pan out. And if you're a big corporate capitalist, big banker, hey, I'd love guarantees. But of course, who's going to pay for that down the road? It's the taxpayers who finance the World Bank.
They want to socialize the risk of all of these climate projects. And why do they want to do that? Because they're very, very expensive. You know, let's get to the root of this. If you go back and you look at every country in the history of humanity that has worked itself up from poverty into a middle class status or some level of wealth, they have done it with affordable energy. It is the only way you do it, and it is the biggest challenge in places like Africa right now. You want to know what the problem with Africa is? Almost all of its energy is renewable. Meaning that, and by the way, it's not solar panels and it's not windmills, it's wood.
Yeah, it's wood.
They're burning the oldest renewable fuel ever. 78% of their energy comes from burning wood, which has all kinds of other environmental issues like deforestation and indoor air pollution. You know that 600 million Africans have no access to electricity at all in sub-Saharan Africa, which excludes South Africa. So what we want to be doing is affordable projects of the type that have propelled every other developing nation into some level of middle class, whether that be India or China, and you do it through burning coal, you do it through doing natural gas, you lift people out of poverty, at which point they're then more able to invest in the kind of luxurious projects that John Kerry thinks are mainstream because he lives in Martha's Vineyard. And so they know this economic reality, but they're resisting it and they want to co-opt all of these international institutions for their agenda. And by the way, if you aren't going to get on board and take orders from that, they're going to pillory you in the public forum.
Yeah. Now, of course, Joe, that Kim is getting to the essence of the contradiction here, which is the World Bank has a fundamental mission of anti-poverty. It's supposed to lift tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty with investments that will make a difference. And energy is part of that. But you have to have energy that's affordable and efficient if you want to do that. So what do you think, Joe, about the possibility here that the Biden Treasury will push him out? Axios published a story saying, yeah, there's, this is speculative, saying who knows that the Treasury is looking into all of this and might push him out. Bloomberg had a similar story, and Axios reported that Al Gore might want the job. Well, he'd have to take a significant pay cut, be given all of his climate investments. That would be fun to go through if he does get the job. Well, I don't know. He doesn't have to go through Senate confirmation, so we may never find out all of the green investments he's made and how well they have done. But what do you think is going to happen, Joe?
Well, I think that there is a real potential that Treasury under, you know, in the Biden administration might find itself getting bounced into trying to replace Malpass before his term is up, simply because I think that if you kind of look at the context of this discussion, at the kind of event where this was going on, you know, with Al Gore's role in this new rhetorical campaign against David Malpass, the fact that John Kerry seems to be sympathetic to it, you can just see the pressure mounting on the progressive environmental left to try to take action now that that seed has been planted in some form. And the Biden administration does not have a particularly good track record resisting that kind of pressure. And I think that there's also this feeling on the environmental left, if they are honest, that this is a moment where they need to really be circling the wagons to try to get as many of their people into that kind of post as they can, because I think that the other important piece of context here is that in developed economies, the countries that foot the bill for institutions like the World Bank, they're all in the middle of various energy crises right now, which are happening because of the failure of a lot of the renewables that Al Gore now wants the World Bank to subsidize. So, I mean, if Malpass's regular term would be up in 2024, by the time we get to that point, would it be politically possible to try to put someone like Al Gore in that job to push this agenda in the developing countries? Or might there be a feeling that they need to do it now while there's still a political chance to do so? I think that might be a big part of the calculation that will go on there as Treasury figures out what they want to do.
Well, we shall see what happens, but I agree with you. This administration, particularly Treasury, which has the usual final say over the nomination to, and the president has the final say, but Treasury's recommendation is usually followed. And Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, has been very weak in resisting pressure to oust certain officials or the executive director at the IMF. Pushed out. There was the Inter-American Development Bank head is now being pushed out on phony ethics charges. So we'll have to watch this. And it would be a shame if Malpass were pushed out because he's done a creditable job at that post. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Joe. And thank you all for listening. Be sure to send us your comments and questions at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please do hit that subscribe button. Wall Street Journal subscribers can also join Kim and Karl Rove and yours truly for a live opinion event. Can Republicans retake Congress on Monday, October 17th at 7 p.m.? That will be live in Dallas or streamed online. And for more information, go to wsjplus.com/opinionlive for tickets and more information. And as always, we will be back here tomorrow for another edition of Potomac Watch.